Every time I come back and teach, I feel really I feel the blessing of it and the blessing of this land. So I'm delighted to be here and share it with you. And today is a day about embodied mindfulness. So I'm a professor and I'm a scientist, and I'm also a meditation teacher. And for me, what I notice is meditation becomes very mental. It becomes very technical and very mental, and am I doing it right, and am I sitting perfectly, and the mind's working really hard, and the body gets a little bit left behind. And so today, the reason we've called it embodied mindfulness is really to start to bring this practice into the body, which is where our aliveness is, right? And so as I'm speaking today, and I am going to share a little bit of the neuroscience, and you know, I'm a professor, I can't help it, I have my PowerPoints. But I'm going to invite us to stay awake in our bodies and to really see if we can listen with our whole being instead of listening with the brain. The brain doesn't really always know what's best, and it also doesn't really know how to absorb and receive all of the information. And so, oh, we're not quite up. This should be slideshow, but we're really close, you guys, from current slide. All right. How does it look to you guys? Oh, good. Okay. I also just want to take a moment and acknowledge a couple of people. Jack Kornfield is my main teacher, and acknowledge him. Tara Brock, John Kabat-Zinn, Roger Walsh, Shinzen Young. And then these are my grandparents. This is Ben and Nancy Friedman. And they don't meditate, and they're not Buddhist. But they have taught me as much about mindfulness as any two people in the world. Because their sense of aliveness, of curiosity, of passion, of just being fully awake in their bodies and open, that's really what mindfulness is about. And so I invite that today, that we're really learning a universal practice, that this isn't just a Buddhist technique. And we have these amazing, beautiful statues behind me, and I want to honor the lineage, and it's universal. Okay? So this is what we're going to be doing this afternoon, basically looking at what is mindfulness, is it helpful, the importance of self-compassion. Then I have my beautiful assistant, Monique Ferris, and she's going to be leading us through mindful movement. She is beginning to do wonderful work with children with cancer, leading movement and dance, and she's gone through trainings in soul motion and mindfulness, and she's extraordinary. And then we'll finish with a loving kindness meditation. So the word mindfulness actually means to see clearly. Is that surprising to anyone? It doesn't mean relaxation. It doesn't mean like getting to some states of nirvana. It's really about seeing clearly what's happening in this moment. So right now, noticing, are you warm? Are you tired? Are you hungry? Are you excited? Are you bored? Whatever it is, noticing how you feel, seeing it clearly. That's all we're trying to do. And the way we do this is by paying attention, okay? The way that we see clearly what's happening is we actually pay attention. So I've been speaking now for maybe 2.5 minutes, 3 minutes. How many people have noticed that your mind has wandered off? Come on, every single person has wandered off. Anthony. our minds wander. It's what they do. It's referred to as monkey mind. So the mind wanders off and we bring it back. It wanders off again, you bring it back again. What I'm going to invite, even as people are coming in and there's more disturbances, see if you can stay right here for just the next 2 minutes. See if you can keep your mind right here in this room on my voice and start to practice the sustaining of attention. And yet, mindfulness isn't just about attention. Otherwise, you could be a sniper and be the most mindful person in the world, right? Snipers are extraordinary at focusing attention. So knowing why we're paying attention, what is our intention, and also how we're paying attention, the attitude with which we pay attention. Are we critical and judgmental and trying to do it right, trying to be perfect, or is there kind of a fluidity and openness and a softness? Okay, so mindfulness actually is composed of these three elements: intention, attention, and attitude. Okay, are you guys with me? So mindfulness is learning how to pay attention in this purposeful way with kindness, with curiosity, with openness, to be like, oh, what does it feel like now? 2 minutes ago, are you guys still with me? Or did your minds wander off? right? 2 minutes ago, I was hot. Now I'm even hotter. Or now I'm noticing I'm more interested or less. So I want to talk about each of these very briefly, but intention is simply knowing why we're doing what we're doing. Okay? And if you think about it, we often go through life on automatic pilot and we forget, why am I here? Right? How did I end up in this job? You know, or how did I end up marrying this person? We get on automatic pilot. And so part of this practice is about waking up and really reflecting on what is true. What do I value? What is most important? I like this. It says, intention is not a destination, it's a direction. We're setting the compass of our heart and we're saying, this is the direction I want to head. Okay? Jon Kabat-Zinn has a beautiful quote. He says, your intentions set the stage for what is possible. They remind you moment to moment of why you are practicing. He said, I used to think meditation was so powerful that as long as you did it at all, you would see growth and change. But time has taught me some kind of personal vision is necessary. Okay? Why are you here? Really, why are you here? Right? Suzuki Roshi puts it perfectly. He says, the most important thing is to remember the most important thing. That's it, right? It doesn't even matter what's most important to you. What matters is that you know. So I'll give you an example. This is my son, Jackson, up here. He's a little bit older now. And I was away teaching last year in Europe, and I was gone for 2 weeks. He's 9 years old, and it was the longest we'd been apart. And on the airplane ride home, I was feeling a lot of guilt and also some anxiety about, like, how's it going to be, and was I gone for too long, and have I disrupted our relationship? And I made this very clear intention. I remember so clearly saying, when I get home, I'm going to spend my first day not even looking at email or opening mail. I just want Jackson to know, mommy's home, you're safe, I love you. Okay, so that was my intention. So I got home, and it was a beautiful day in Marin, and I decided we would go to Muir Beach. We love going to the beach. So I packed up everything to go to the beach, and, you know, nine-year-olds have a lot of beach stuff, so it took me a while, and, you know, packed picnics and was, every, you know, all ready to have our perfect day and reconnect. And then I said, hey, Jackson, okay, we're going to go. And he's like, I don't want to go. I was like, what? We're going to go have our perfect day at the beach. And, like, you're going to know how much I love you. Come on, let's go. And, you know, so he put on his bathing suit and he kind of dragged his feet. And we start walking out the door. And I'm like 10 feet ahead of him, kind of on my agenda to be the perfect mom. And I get to the car. I'm loading it. And he sat down in our front yard and he's not coming. And I noticed this kind of contraction and patience start to rise in me. And then luckily I'd been teaching mindfulness every day for 2 weeks in Europe, so I had some awareness. And I was like, wait a minute, what's the most important thing? What was my intention? Oh yeah, all I want to do is connect with my son. All I want to do is let him know I'm home and I love him and I want to be with him. So that just dropped the agenda and I was able to walk back over to him and sit down, and he was looking at these ants. They were actually pretty amazing. They're pretty amazing, those ants. And I sat down next to him, and we were sitting there, and he just leaned his little body into mine. And I could feel the sun on my back, and I could feel our presence reconnecting. Okay. So that's intention. That's reminding us why we're doing what we're doing in the first place. Okay. This is essential to mindfulness. So I'd like you to close your eyes for a moment and just reflect on why you're here. What is your intention? And see if you can let it come from the body, not from the mind. Why are you here? What's most important to you in this moment? And as you're ready, you can let your eyes open. And I'm curious if a few people would share, what's your intention? Why are you here? Yeah.
To feel connected.
To feel connected. Beautiful. Beautiful. What else?
Just to be here now.
Just to be here now. Wonderful. What else?
To
remember what's important.
To remember what's important. Yeah, the word mindfulness means actually, it means to see clearly, but it also means to remember, to actually remember who we truly are. Yeah, great.
Mm-hmm. All of that, plus I'm learning to be a meditation teacher and I'm here to learn from you.
Beautiful. So all of that plus learning to be a meditation teacher. Wonderful. Pay close attention. Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
To learn something about being at greater peace with myself, for myself and also for my family and my clients.
Yeah. So to learn to be at greater peace with yourself. I remember my dance teacher saying to me, relax so that other people around you can relax. Right? And that's part of this practice is we learn how to hold ourselves with kindness so that we can start to create more ease in other people's lives. Great. Wonderful. So, yeah.
To be reminded of my intention.
To be reminded of your intention. Yeah. Just your intention in the world going through life. Beautiful. We forget. We forget so quickly and so easily. I'm stunned. I wake up in the day each morning and I make an intention and I, you know, feel like I've got it and it's clear and I'm going to be like right on. And 5 minutes later, I'm snapping at my son or I'm like, you know, frustrated in traffic or whatever it is. And none of those are wrong or bad, but it's like forgetting what's most important. Yeah. Okay. So this is the first element of mindfulness, intention. The second element is attention. And here's the monkey referring to our monkey mind. So again, noticing, now I've been talking for like 12 minutes. Have you noticed your mind wandering off? Come on, let's see. No, actually, you don't even have to raise your hands. I know all of you, right? Our minds wander. It's what they do. They jump from thought to thought like a monkey jumps from limb to limb in a tree. Our mind wanders almost 50% of the time. They did a study with 650,000 people and your mind wanders 46.9% of the time. That's half your life. So let's say you live to be 100. That's 50 years you're spacing out. And that's not even counting sleep time. So I guess it's even more. I mean, that's extraordinary. Right? So this practice is about waking up. And to do so, we need to train our attention so that we can actually be here. Right here. Because your body's here. No one's left. And yet your mind's all over the place. And there's this kind of empty shell sitting here. And so this practice is about unifying the mind and body and really allowing all of our resources to be available. So this is one of my favorite quotes. It's by Emil Phillips. He says, I used to think the brain was the most wonderful organ in my body. Then I realized who was telling me this. Right? We believe our thoughts. They're not true. You have 12 to 50,000 thoughts every single day. Most of them are the exact same. Your thoughts are not that interesting. They're not true and they're rarely helpful. Sometimes, I'm not saying they're all wrong, but we need to learn to see our thoughts clearly instead of just believing them. And we need to learn to recognize that our thoughts are not us. They arise and they pass away. They are not who I truly am. And we give so much credence to our thoughts. We completely ignore our body and our body sensations. We give so much credence to our thoughts. So part of this practice is learning how to pay attention in the present moment, see thoughts as they arise, but not get carried away by them. I remember when I was 5 years old, my dad was teaching me to meditate. And he said, imagine you're sitting under a busy highway and there's cars racing over your head. These cars are your thoughts. He said, don't climb in the car and drive away. Just notice it. Blue car, orange car, yellow car. Okay, don't drive away with your thoughts. And it takes practice. Okay. So with mindfulness, what we're doing is we're stabilizing our attention. I kind of think of your mind as like this puppy dog and it wanders off. And you're like, stay, come back. And it wanders off again. And you're like, come back. Every time your mind wanders off, you don't slap yourself and be like, damn it, Shauna, come back. There's a gentleness. There's a kindness. There's like, oh, sweetheart, whoops, come back. Okay? So the third element of mindfulness, and then we'll do a little practice. But the third element is our attitude. And this is how we pay attention. So what I noticed when I was first learning to practice, I was in Thailand at this monastery, and this is supposed to be a drawing of it. It kind of looks like it, Wat Swan Mok. And I didn't speak any Thai, and I was 19 years old, and I didn't know anything about meditation. I was actually traveling, going to the full moon parties in Koh Phangan, and I met a monk, and he was like, come with me to this monastery, and I said, okay. And so I didn't speak any Thai, and we got there, and the lead teacher kind of, you know, pointed to his nose and said, feel the breath come in and out through your nostrils. And I said, sure, I'll sign up for a 2-week silent retreat, and I did. And I remember sitting there the first day, and you know, my mind was going crazy and there's thoughts everywhere, and I would pay attention to one breath and maybe I would pay attention to two, and then my mind would wander off. And I'd bring it back as hard as I could, and I'd try harder and harder. And I just started getting more and more frustrated and more anxious and more tense and judgmental, and like, who do I think I am that I can meditate? And I'm not, you know, all these other people know how to do it better and there's something wrong with me. And by the third day, I was just this like anxious knot of judgment and frustration. And this beautiful monk flew in from London who spoke English, was Western, and I had an interview with him because you're also in silence. So I'm just in there with my own mind, which was not very pretty. And he comes in and I had an interview and he looked at me and I told him what was happening. He goes, oh dear, you're not practicing mindfulness. And I'm like, what? He goes, no, no, you're practicing judgment, impatience, striving, frustration. He said, what you practice gets stronger. Those five words really profoundly changed my life. What you practice gets stronger. This practice of mindfulness is about practicing acceptance. Oh, my mind's wandered off. Huh. Interest, curiosity, openness, compassion, kindness, right? It's not about how many breaths you pay attention to. Ooh, I got 100 that sitting. It's about what am I practicing? What neural pathways am I creating? So I offer these kind of as a heuristic, these words, because mindfulness isn't just about paying attention. It's not just about the present moment. It's about how you pay attention. Every single moment, not just when we're meditating, but right now, what is the quality of your attention? And I want to make it clear, this doesn't mean that you're supposed to be happy all the time, okay? It doesn't mean that you just put on a smile. What it means is that there's this, sorry, I have to hold this because I don't know how it hooks on, but mindfulness is like a big pot, okay? And this pot is always kind. It's always gracious. It's always open. It's always curious. It's always like the best parent you could imagine saying, sweetheart, come tell me what's happening. And what's happening might be, I'm pissed off, or I'm scared, or I feel embarrassed, or I'm exhausted, or I'm sad. And we're holding our experience with kindness. So we're not making our experience have to be happy and joyful all the time. We're allowing whatever's here to be here because we're just seeing it clearly. That's mindfulness. But we're holding it in a very different way. Does that make sense? You guys still with me? All right. Intention, attention, and attitude. So this is the Japanese kanji for the word mindfulness. It's comprised of two characters. The top character looks like a little hat. The bottom character, shin, means mind or heart. In Asian languages, they're interchangeable. So mindfulness could have been translated as presence of heart. That's what this means. Or heartfulness. Can you imagine? Think how different it feels just to say, oh, I'm going to go practice heartful meditation today instead of mindful meditation. Or this is a heartfulness center instead of a mindfulness center. It's a very different feeling in our body, and it's equally accurate. So what I'd like to do is practice a little bit of this mindful heartfulness. So go ahead and move your body in any way that feels good and just let your eyes close. If you need to stand up for a moment, you can do that. Stand up and then just sit back down. We will be doing movement, I promise. See if you can sit down and see if you can lean your attention a little bit back. We lean forward so much of the time, kind of leaning into the future. So see if you can lean back. And then we'll begin just like we did earlier by just feeling ourselves arrive in the body. So begin to gather your awareness, gather your attention right here in the present moment. And just setting the intention to be here in a kind, open way. That we're just exploring. This is an adventure. We're just saying, what's happening right now? What does it feel like to be alive in this body, in this moment? So feeling your feet and wiggling your toes and just feeling how you're anchored to the ground, to the earth. Connect with both legs, with your seat in the chair, with the spine straight and upright supporting you. Soften the shoulders, soften the arms. Soften the belly. Just let it relax. And feel the ribs up into the chest. And just touching into the heart. It's still beating. You still don't have to tell it to or think about it. Just feel it. Softening the shoulders. Bringing the awareness up through the throat, into the jaw, relaxing the cheeks, the eyes, the forehead, the temples. Feeling the sides and back of the head, the back of the neck. And again, just leaning the awareness into the back body and down. And then opening our attention. Opening to the sensation of breath. Opening to sound. It could be the sound of your own breath, the sound of the chimes outside. Sound of your neighbor, just opening to the sensation of sound. Relaxing the body 5% more, and at the same time, heighten your attention. We're relaxed, yet we're alert. There's a clarity, a wisdom in the relaxation. And we're just opening to whatever's here. So if any emotions arise in the body or sensations, we notice them with our kind, curious attention. If we have thoughts like, I'm not doing it right, or this is great, or I need to teach this to my mother-in-law, just notice the thoughts. They're just thoughts. They're like clouds passing in the sky. We notice them, we let them go. Practicing presence. What we practice gets stronger. Right now you're developing these neural pathways of attention and of kindness. Each moment, every single breath counts. And if your mind wanders off and you come back with kindness, you're practicing self-compassion. You're getting better at that. So it doesn't matter what's happening right now. All that matters is you're present for it. noticing where your mind is. And if it's wandered off, notice where it went and then bring it back. Just like the little puppy dog. Come back, stay. Being interested in your own experience. Noticing if you disconnect from your body and just welcoming yourself back into the body. Welcoming yourself home here. And just recognizing how wholesome it is, how good for you it is to just rest in this way with whatever's happening. And for the last 2 minutes of this practice, really see if you can be here, strengthening your intention and your attention, and yet staying soft, staying open. And into this place of relative stillness, inviting in a word or an intention or even just a felt sense of what you want to bring with you, of what's most important. And as you're ready, taking a deeper breath in and out, bringing some movement back into the body as you wiggle the fingers and toes and rotate the wrists and ankles, stretching the arms up above the head and just letting some light come back in through the eyes. And notice that the mindfulness continues. Even as the meditation ends, the mindful awareness is right here, right? There's a seamless continuity of awareness. So what I'm going to invite now is that you gently and softly get into groups of two or three, and I want you to share very briefly what you experienced. So not how you're going to start doing this every day next week, but what did you actually notice right here in this moment? Okay, we'll just take a couple of minutes to do that.
Amazing. We got the speaker, we got the thing.
Yeah, well, I talked to my boss and she said that the
It's a So just taking another moment to finish up. So as you're ready, coming back to the larger group. Okay. Sixty is definitely not too old. So we're going to come back to the larger group now. So what did you guys notice? What did you notice as we did this practice? Yeah.
My mind wanders much more than I thought it did.
So she says, my mind wanders much more than I thought it did. How many other people noticed that? So look around the room. I'm expecting everyone's hand to be raised. Absolutely. It's one of the first insights we have is, oh my God, my mind is so out of control. How have I been living, really? You know, and we're so much of our resources have not been available to us because we're just not here. We're just not present. Yeah, great noticing. And then no judgment. It's just the way it is, right? And it can shift. All right, what else? Yeah.
I noticed that my wandered thoughts triggered other wandered thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Come back like as soon as it wandered instead of waiting like four thoughts down.
Yes, that's very skillful. She said her wandering thoughts triggered other wandering thoughts. In Buddhism, it's called papancha, where it's like you just get this like attack of millions of different thoughts and they're all like weaving into each other. So as soon as you notice it, right? As soon as the little knot starts tying, you want to untie it so you don't get a huge ball. So great noticing. Again, this is a skill. We're just developing a skill. You know, if I said, here's a violin, like go play Vivaldi, you know, how's it going to sound? So we're kind of fine tuning the mind a little bit. Okay, what else? What else did you guys notice? Yeah.
I just went somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. 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 So it's helpful to do it in a group and with a teacher for you. And you said you went somewhere else. What do you mean by somewhere else?
I don't know. I was just nowhere. I went into a space of nothing.
Of just kind of non-dual resting. Yeah, so wonderful. It's interesting with mindfulness. This specific practice we're learning today is really about seeing clearly what's actually right here in this moment. And so even though sometimes there's like perhaps a desire to go somewhere else, like to that calm, beautiful place in Hawaii or to a place where there's no difficulties, where this practice really supports us in our daily life is if we can be right here with things as they are. And so my invitation is maybe in another meditation that we do later to see if you can stay here with us. Yeah, if that feels good. And if it doesn't, you do your own practice. Most important with this is that we learn how to listen to our own compass. Okay? What else? Yeah.
I was very grateful that you suggested leaning back.
She was grateful I suggested leaning back. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I felt this very strong sense of being grounded, and I leaned back.
Beautiful. Yeah, so a sense of being grounded when you lean back. One of my teachers said, before you speak, I want 70% of your weight in your back body, and I want you to feel the envelope of your skin. And then you can talk. now just sit there in her therapy office and be like, I'm going to go really slow. Right? Great. Great noticing. Great noticing. Yeah. So thoughts appear in two different forms. One is the audio and the other is the visual. And some people get audio visual if you're lucky, right? So you are having the visual mental images as thoughts, and we work with them in the exact same way. So we notice, thinking or a mental image, and we come back. And it's kind of, it can get interesting in there sometimes. And so again, it's a practice, it's a discipline. Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah.
I have no pain in my shoulders and neck generally when I'm talking.
Uh-huh.
But when I got quiet, it was like an almost unbearable
Yeah. Yeah. Are you noticing it right now?
No.
Interesting. Yeah. I'd be curious, see if you can bring your attention there and see what's here right now. But a lot of times when we pay attention in this still way, what starts to surface are the pains that we've pushed down physically and emotionally, right? Sometimes I'll be sitting and a wave of grief will overtake me and it's like, I don't even have to figure out where it came from. It just is arising and needs to be attended to, okay? So I wouldn't worry about it. Usually those pains go away after the meditation, and they just need attention. And so instead of panicking about it or being what's wrong, just to be like, oh, ouch, let me give you a little attention. Yeah. This practice more and more for me becomes just like being a mom, you know, just like, oh, sweetheart, that hurts. You know, because normally we're like, what's wrong with you? Like, buck up, you know? And there's this way that we're not really that generous with ourselves or kind to ourselves. And so this practice is really about putting this kind attention right here. Right here, so that we can open it out to the world. Yeah, great, great. What else did you notice? Or questions about kind of, yeah.
I noticed, I felt sort of frustrated because I kept thinking things that I didn't want to be thinking.
So she said, I felt frustrated because I kept thinking things I didn't want to be thinking. Did anyone else have that experience? Now, do you believe me? You're not in control of your mind because you would not be choosing to have those thoughts. Like if I was in charge, I'd be having some pretty great thoughts. They're not the thoughts that are coming in, right? So again, we learn how to work with thinking. And in the beginning, you're gonna have a ton of thoughts. 50% of your time, you're going to be wandering around. So what we're doing is maybe 1% more, 2% more. And again, it's like going to the gym and lifting weights and like all of a sudden, you know, I haven't been doing a lot of it, but the muscle starts to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And so we're training these muscles of our brain, right? And it's so exciting. In fact, I'm going to move now into the science because, you know, up until the 1990s, we thought that our brain was static and that like by the time you were about 20 years old, it was kind of like, this is your brain, you know, and this is the way it's going to be. And what we're shown now is that with neuroplasticity, our brain continues to change. And so what we practice, our repeated experiences, shape our brain. And so there's this kind of encouragement that, you know, who cares how old you are and who cares how many thoughts that are frustrating you've had right now? It's a new moment. And there's infinite possibility in this moment. And life becomes kind of this miraculous place where if you believe that, if you believe right now in this moment there's infinite possibilities, it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. Okay? So I want to shift. Oh, I want to read this poem by Rumi, and then I'll shift. So this is the guest house, and if you have no other meditation instruction, I think this is the best. He says, "This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes." Can you imagine that? Welcome and entertain them all. The malice, the dark thought, the shame. When are you welcoming those? You know, normally we're like, oh, God, no, that can't be me. This practice is about welcoming whoever's here, the pain in my shoulder, the frustrating thoughts, the images, whatever it is, we're saying welcome. And we're trusting in our capacity to hold it and not get caught by it. Yeah, great. Okay. So let's take a moment and just stretch for our bodies. So go ahead and stand up and stretch your body and breathe. We're going to go for about another half an hour before we take a break. So if you need to use the restroom, you may, but if you can make it through the science, it's going to be fun. And you can close your eyes. Whoa, this is really not very tall. And just shake out your body. And when you're ready, you can find your seat again. Oh. And my invitation at this point is really to keep coming back to your body. So right now, and you're welcome to stand too, but I'd like to invite you to choose an anchor place in your body for this next piece. Maybe we'll go about 20 minutes. So you can choose your feet, or you can choose the, you know, roof of your mouth or your tongue, or I like to choose my feet, but whatever works for you. And as I'm speaking, keep coming back to this place in your body. And not coming back like militant come back, but like come back with gentleness and ease and be like, hey, how you doing? Oh yeah, we're still connected. We're still here. So I want to talk a bit about the science, and I was never planning on being a professor or a scientist. This was definitely not my life path. I loved mindfulness, right? I started practicing when I was 19, and I was like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And my parents were like, well, you kind of have to get a job at some point. And so like, all right, I'll study this stuff. You know, I want to see what happens because I was really curious. I was like, it was what I'm experiencing happening for everyone. And how can it be helpful and for who and in what ways and how do we teach it? So the question really is mindfulness helpful? Short answer, yes. But I'm going to go through a little bit of the research. There has been about 4 decades of research showing significant psychological and physiological impact of mindfulness. And I think they have my book back there, but in our book, The Art and Science of Mindfulness, we go into great depth in all the research. So today I'm just going to very briefly summarize it, and you can look deeper if you're interested. But basically, mindfulness has been shown to decrease a lot of physical disorders. It's been shown to help with psoriasis, which is a very uncomfortable skin disorder. It's actually a pretty amazing study that they published in the Journal of Dermatology. So the treatment for psoriasis is photochemotherapy, where you stand in this small booth and you get photochemotherapy. You stand there naked and they, you know, whatever, douse you in it or however, I don't know how to describe it. And so what they did is they had half the people get photochemotherapy and the other half get photochemotherapy while practicing mindfulness and listening to a CD. The people who listened to the CD, their skin cleared 35% faster. It's extraordinary. It cost no more money, took no more time, right? It's been shown to decrease chronic pain, to decrease symptoms of fibromyalgia, to decrease symptoms of cancer, and also to improve immune functioning in people who have cancer. It's been shown to decrease symptoms of multiple sclerosis, to decrease tension headaches, hypertension, to increase immune function in, quote, healthy normals. And this is this new research on the telomeres. Have people heard about the telomeres and telomerase? It's kind of gotten a lot of press because it's the best physiological marker of aging, right? So everyone's super excited. Like this is what, you know, can keep you young forever. And what they're showing is that mindfulness increases the telomerase, which lengthens your telomeres. And your telomeres, basically, when they are gone, you're dead. That's, you die. So people who go to war and come back are veterans. Their telomeres shorten while they're gone. People who are chronic caregivers and in really stressful marriages, their telomeres shorten. When people meditate, even in just 8 weeks, their telomeres lengthen. Okay? Extraordinary. It's also been shown to decrease depression, to decrease anxiety and panic attacks, to decrease insomnia. We actually just published a study that I did at Stanford University integrating mindfulness with cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia, and it was amazing. What was funny is, like, in my meditation classes, people kept falling asleep when we do the body scan. And I'd be like, no, you're supposed to fall awake. Come on, don't, you know, they'd be snoring, they fall asleep. They're like, your voice is too soothing. And I'm like, oh. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, maybe we should teach this to people who can't fall asleep and see what happens. And it worked great. They all pass right out and they listen to my voice. It's perfect. So it decreases insomnia. It decreases binge eating, attention deficit disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder. It decreases substance abuse and helps with smoking cessation. So a wide range of treatment for pathologies. However, if you think about the original intention of meditation, right? It wasn't to decrease panic attacks, although that's really important and important work. But there's a whole another dimension to this practice, which is how do we grow and develop and thrive? How do we increase these positive psychological states? So I wanted to share some of the research that shows the impact of meditation on positive states. It's been shown to increase our self-awareness, our capacity to self-regulate, our empathy. Empathy is the best predictor of relationship health. It's the best predictor, okay? It's just how attuned we are to each other. It increases self-efficacy, our sense of happiness, our sense of control, both our sense of being kind of an agent and being in control, but also our capacity to yield and to recognize sometimes we're not in control. It's been shown to increase spirituality, compassion, moral development, to increase our attention, which makes sense, our concentration, our creativity, our memory, our academic performance. So great when I'm at medical schools and law schools, they get really excited about that. It reduces cognitive rigidity. This is one of my favorite ones. So cognitive rigidity means we're like, this is the way things are, or that's who that person is. I know you, right? Cognitive flexibility is this kind of openness to data and saying, huh, I wonder what's going to happen in this moment. I have no idea. And so they did this study. It's called the glass jar study. And they gave a whole group, let's say these are, you guys are the meditators and you guys are the non-meditators. So we gave all of you 6 glass jars. And we said, you have to get, you know, this much water in this many jars and you have this much time. Go. And it required a very complex mathematical equation to figure out how many water things you have to do. I'm not explaining it well, but you get the idea. So it required very complex math. So who do you think did better, the meditators or the non-meditators? Nope. Meditators are not better at math. They did the exact same. But the second step of the study is they gave them 3 jars and they're like, now do it. And this actually required a very simple mathematical equation. Now the meditators who had kind of a beginner's mind started from scratch. The non-meditators kept trying to use their really complex equation they had figured out in the last one. They're like, oh, I worked so hard for that one. And they kept trying to use it. It was a very rigid approach. And so the meditators did much better. Okay, so that's an example of cognitive rigidity versus flexibility. And then the last study we just completed a year and a half ago was with college freshmen. And we looked at, could we increase ethical decision-making by teaching them meditation? Very bold study. And we found after 7 weeks, we significantly increased ethical decision-making in college freshmen. They're making a lot of unethical choices during that first year, I will tell you. I forgot, but it was amazing. Okay, so meditation and the brain. This is the research that I get most excited about. This is what I was sharing before with neuroplasticity. So I'm going to give you just very little background information, and this has nothing to do with meditation. This is just brain research. So emotions and our experience looks different in the brain. If we're happy, if we're alert, if we feel good, then we have a higher left to right ratio in the prefrontal cortex. Okay, the prefrontal cortex, so if this is your brain, the prefrontal cortex, this is where this gets tricky. It's right here. Okay, so the brain evolved, and we have kind of the reptilian stem brain, and then the prefrontal cortex evolved last. And this is our emotion regulation, our moral reasoning, our higher order functioning, our emotional intelligence. And so in this little part of the brain, when you feel alert and happy and joyful, you have a higher left to right ratio of activity. You know, if we hook you up here, look at this guy. If we hook you up to our monitors, right? This is the EEG monitor. We can look at these little signatures, and that's like bloop, she's happy, bloop, oop, not so happy. They're not very, no, they're feeling really sad today. Okay, so when you're feeling sad and depressed and anxious, you have a higher right to left ratio. And in fact, if you have severe depression or a post-traumatic stress disorder, you have a significantly higher right to left ratio. So what they did is they brought 175 people in to measure them. And then they brought in this Tibetan Lama. And his left to right ratio was off the charts. And then when they said, meditate on joy and compassion and love, it went even higher. And so they started to wonder, like, is this just a random artifact? Like, is this, you know, he was just born happy and then, you know, he went off and meditated? Or is this because he meditated for tens of thousands of hours and actually changed his brain? So they did the gold standard in science. They did a randomized controlled trial. They took 40 people and they said, you're here, you're here, you're here, you're here. They taught these guys to meditate. And then 4 months later, they found that their left-sided activation had increased. That in 4 months, you can actually change the activity of your brain. So here's why this is so exciting. I was always taught in college and in graduate school that there's a happiness set point. Okay? And research has borne this out for decades, that basically you're born with a certain temperament and you're born happy or you're not. And this was based on research that when people win the lottery, they have this initial spike and then they go back a year later to their baseline. When people are in terrible, tragic accidents and become paraplegic, a year later, they're back to their baseline. They have a huge dip, of course, but a year later, they're back to their baseline. So the interpretation was basically like, some people are born happy and it doesn't really matter what happens. You know, they're like Bobo dolls. It's like you get divorced, you get knocked down and they just pop right back up and they're like, whoop, I'm okay again. And then they get knocked down again and they're right back up. They're threes on the Enneagram. Some people weren't born happy. And those are most of the people that I work with. And it was kind of depressing news to be like, all right, you get the house in Hawaii, you marry the perfect person, you win the lottery. 1 year later, you're going to feel just like you do right now. Right? And if you look at our culture, we're trying so hard to buy happiness or to find it outside of ourselves. And the equation's fundamentally flawed. Right? You're going to get the initial blip and you're going to go back to baseline. So what's exciting and what's optimistic about this new research is that, yes, if you change your external environment, you will not change your happiness level. However, if you change your interior landscape, your internal environment, you can change your happiness level. You can actually change the activity in your brain in 4 months. You can actually change the structure of your brain. The entire structure, you can grow new neurons. You can make certain parts of the brain that have to do with happiness and joy and compassion big, right? Just like that going to the gym analogy. I'm going to go to the gym and do bicep curls just for these presentations, right? But we are strengthening these dimensions of who we are, and we have a choice in every single moment. What do you want to choose? What do you want to practice? Literally right now, what are you practicing? Okay? So what I'm talking about, this is Richie Davidson who did a lot of this research. He says happiness can be trained because the very structure of the brain can be modified. All of this has to do with neuroplasticity. The fact that our experience shapes our brain. When you look at taxi drivers and you look at their brains, their visual spatial mapping is huge. Huge, right? That's what they're practicing all day long. When you look at meditators, these are brains from Harvard. That makes them, I think, more impressive. These are brains from Harvard. The parts of the brain that have to do with compassion, attention, emotion regulation, emotional intelligence are bigger and stronger. There's more cortical thickening there. And the more people practice, the stronger they are. So habits are human nature. Okay, and we have these super highways of habit, right? We know what ours are. And I like to think of this practice of like, I have my super highway of habit. Like for me, impatience is one of them. It's just, I've practiced it a lot. It's part of who I am. And I can start to kind of dig out this little country road of compassion or patience or kindness. And it's not as fast as the other pathway. And there's like brambles and barbs and, you know, lots of overgrown plants. And I'm like down there, I'm like, damn it, this is kind of hard work. But I'm digging out this little pathway. And every single time I do, it gets stronger and the path gets cleared. And soon-ish, you start to develop these new neural pathways where instead of snapping or instead of going so fast, there's a pause. And I'm like, whoa, I just paused. And not only does it impact that moment, it impacts the next moment. We start to have choice. And so it's up to you what you want to practice. It's up to you what's most important to you. I'm never going to say, well, this is what you, these are the, right? But what mindfulness does is it gives us choice. It allows us to see clearly, what do I most value? What do I want to cultivate in this moment, right here? So what I like to say in this point, and we'll take a break in just a couple of minutes, but there kind of gets to be a little bit of pressure right here in the presentation, because all of a sudden you're like, well, shit, I better be practicing like good stuff all the time. And I just, that's a bit of what's called golden shackles. It's a prison. And for me, it's kind of the prison I fell into, you know? And so I had always wanted to be perfect and do things right and get lots of approval. And I kind of figured out how to do that in the external world. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, well, now I'm just going to do it in my spiritual world. So I'm going to be like the kindest, most compassionate, like most calm, you know? And there was a way in which my meditation practice actually became one more way that I was beating myself up. One more way that I wasn't doing it right and I wasn't good enough. So practice is not about becoming perfect. That's not our goal. This is not a self-improvement project. Okay? So this is a teaching Jack Kornfield gave me, which I love. He says, if you can sit quietly after difficult news, if in financial downturns you remain perfectly calm, if you see your neighbors travel to favorite places without a tinge of jealousy, can happily eat whatever is put on your plate, love everyone around you unconditionally, and always find contentment just where you are, you're probably a dog. Right? Right? You're kind of holding your breath a little when I'm reading that. You're like, oh, no, I'm not quite doing it yet. Damn, I need to practice more. So again, this is not self-improvement. This is liberation. It's self-liberation. This is about freedom. This is about being more okay with who you actually are. And who we are is all of it. It's messy sometimes, right? It's not always pretty. Can I be present with that too? The Dalai Lama is such an extraordinary man. And I heard the story about him. I wasn't present for it. It was about 30 years ago. But on one of his first visits to the United States, he was at a group like this at Insight Meditation Center with a lot of advanced meditation practitioners. And a man raised his hand and he said, Your Holiness, how do you deal with kind of self-hatred and like feeling that you're not, like something's wrong with you? Like there's kind of that bad seed in there and I'm doing something wrong and I'm not quite doing life right. And the Dalai Lama looked at him and he was really, really confused. He was like, I don't understand. And the interpreter was like, boop, 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 boop. And the Dalai Lama was like, boop, 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 boop. You know, they were like, couldn't understand. And then finally he understood and he looked at the man. He's like, that's wrong view. That's wrong view. That it's so harmful to have those thoughts of self-hatred, that it doesn't actually help you change or get better. It's just poison. And I remember when I heard that story, I imagined like if my son was reaching out for a hot coal and he would burn his hand, I'd be like, no, Jackson. And he would forcefully push his hand away. When we're reaching out for those thoughts of I'm not okay, I'm not enough, to actively take your hand off that hot coal. And what's interesting is that the centers of the brain that have to do with learning, they shut down when you feel ashamed. So when you start to criticize yourself and you start to judge yourself because you think you're not good enough, you're actually guaranteeing that you're not going to change. It happens to me a lot with my son. I'm a single mother and I definitely get frustrated sometimes. And when I get frustrated at him, all of a sudden the guilt comes of like, I'm not compassionate, who I'm teaching compassion in the world, and then I'm a hypocrite, and I'm at home, and I'm doing this. And I remember this teaching just liberated me from that because I was like, wait a minute, if I really want to change, if I really want to cultivate that compassion, going into shame about how I'm the worst mother in the world is not going to get me there, okay? All that does is shut down our brain. So my invitation to you really as this day continues is to practice cultivating compassion for yourself and for life as it is, even if it's not how you want it to be. The word compassion in Tibetan is considered incomplete if it doesn't include oneself. It's considered incomplete. And yet so often we think of compassion as, oh, let me help you. Oh, I'm so loving over here. And we forget ourselves. I'm going to tell you one more story and then we're going to take a break because I think it's important with this. I'm a clinical psychologist, and so I work with a lot of different people. And one of the very first cases I had was doing a support group and a mindfulness group for post-traumatic stress disorder with veterans, mostly who had been in the Vietnam War actually back then, and had been carrying and suffering this for a long time. And this was my first group, and we had been in it together for about 2 months. There's about a dozen men. And there was one man who kind of sat in the back, and he just was like this the whole time. And he was looking down at the floor, though. He didn't even look at me, but there was kind of this look on his face like, I don't know what this BS is, and I don't know what you think you're doing, but it's not touching me. And I remember, I mean, I was so wanting to help, and I was feeling really helpless. And then one day he raised his hand, and he didn't look up. He just looked at the ground, and he said, I don't want to get better. And I never heard anyone say that. It didn't even make sense to me. I'm like, I'm a therapist. That's why you're here, to get better. He said, I don't deserve to get better. He said, what I saw and what I did was so wrong that I deserve all of this pain, this suffering, the panic attacks, the nightmares. And he proceeded to share with us what he had seen and what he had done. And I can still feel the horror of it in my body, of the, you know, kind of vicarious trauma as he shared. And as I looked around the room, I remember looking at each person and seeing so much compassion, right? I was worried there would be so much judgment. There was so much compassion, and they all knew what had happened was wrong. No one was like, oh, buddy, it's okay. Everyone knew what had happened was wrong. But there was this total acceptance and compassion. And I invited him just to look up and just be witnessed in that compassion. And it was one of the most extraordinary things I've ever witnessed. You could just see him kind of like coming back to life, like a flower who hasn't had any water or any sunshine, just getting a little bit of it. And many years later, someone sent me this poem, and I wish that I knew his last name or could send him this poem. I wish I had had it at the time, but I want to read it to you now. It's by Galway Kinnell. He says, the bud stands for all things, even those things that do not flower, for everything flowers from within of self-blessing. Though sometimes it's necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to retell it in words and in touch, it is lovely until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. That's what we're doing. That's what this practice is about. We're reteaching ourselves and each other our own loveliness until we flower again from within of self-blessing. So let's just allow our eyes to close for a moment and just let all of this settle in. I forgot to cue you back into that part of your body that you chose so many minutes ago. So find your anchor, feel your body, and just feeling the resonance of these teachings, sensing into what is true for you. And just letting them land and digest. Softening, relaxing the body 5% more. leaning the attention, the awareness back into the back body and down. Feel your feet, feel your heart, feel your breath. And just take a moment to thank yourself for being here. Recognizing that there's something in you that already knows all of this. I'm not teaching you anything you don't already know. So just touching that wise, compassionate place inside of you. Thanking it for arriving you here in this moment. And as you're ready, just taking a deeper breath in and out. Bringing some movement back into the body, stretching the arms up above the head. Letting light back in through the eyes. Beautiful. So we're going to take a 10-minute break. Here's the catch. There's no breaks, really. What you practice gets stronger. So we're going to continue our mindfulness practice, the seamless continuity. I encourage you to go outside. It's so beautiful. And we'll come back at 3:35. Okay, enjoy.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.